Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this ICMDA seminar. My name's Philippa Taylor, and I run a leadership programme, a political leadership programme, but I was a colleague of Peter Staunders, and I'm standing in for him today. So I'm standing in here, and I'm very privileged and grateful that we've got Kelly Fell speaking to us on the subject of exploitation. Kelly works for the Center for Bioethics and Culture, the CBC, in America. The CBC is an educational nonprofit organization that educates people on the topics of medical bioethics, but primarily through film. So today's presentation will be heavily influenced by film, and we'll see lots of media clips. So Kelly will speak for about 30 minutes, and then as per normal, we will have a time of Q&A after that. So my pleasure now just to introduce Kelly. Kelly's been with the Center for Bioethics and Policy for 5 years. She started first as a volunteer, and she's worked her way up to become executive director. She's a perinatal nurse part-time, as well as being exec director. And she's also got a master's degree in reproductive physiology. So we're definitely in expert hands for this topic. So I shall now hand over to Kelly. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This topic we will be focusing mostly on egg donation. And I like to put that in quotes because it's really not an egg donation. It is buying and selling of eggs. But we use the misnomer of donation. But we can't really talk about egg donation without talking about other items such as sperm donation and surrogacy. So we'll briefly talk about those as well. So reproductive ethics. These issues of egg donation, sperm donation, and surrogacy are complicated and often interrelated. So you'll see a lot of the same issues in each of the categories. And we'll talk about three different films that the Center for Bioethics and Culture has created on each of these topics. The first, Exploitation, Anonymous Father's Day, and Breeders, a Subclass of Women. So exploitation, this is where young female egg donors are targeted for their eggs. They're often unknown short and long-term health risks. The result, just like an anonymous sperm donation, is donor-conceived children. It's eugenic in nature. And something that's really important is that egg donors, there's a big conflict of interest because they are not patients. Unlike women who are undergoing fertility treatment, egg donors are rarely considered patients by those who are seeing them and taking care of them, and therefore they receive inadequate care and attention. However, because this woman, this egg donor, is being seen by medical staff in a clinic setting, she fails to understand that she's not a patient, and then she'll enter in an agreement without that clarity, and again, have that conflict of interest. And then the coercion piece that we also see in surrogacy is unlike organ donation in the United States, compensation is not allowed because people will assume undue risk to their bodies for financial need. However, in egg donation and surrogacy, they are allowed to be paid. So women who are in dire situations or might just need some extra cash are often willing to risk their health or think about taking on these risks for their financial gain of that. So money can play a very powerful role in this. So again, in sperm donation, we have donor-conceived children, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Anonymous parenthood, which is really kind of going by the wayside because of new technology. There's really no such thing. There's no regulation on donation. Men can donate as many times, creating issues as well. And then, of course, the psychological risks to both the donors, and that includes egg donors, as well as the children who face bewilderment issues. And then lastly, surrogacy, which we'll talk on briefly. Do we really want to see women as what we call easy bake ovens or my bun or their bun, her oven. There are health and psychological risks now that we know about. There's the disruption of the mother-child bonding and that primal wound, as well as a family disruption for the surrogate mother between her spouse or her children. And then, of course, the role of coercion. Something else I'd like to say briefly about sperm donation is that both sperm and egg donation are inconsistent with the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which holds that the child has a right to know and be cared for by his or her parents. So we have this question of parentage, who are the parents? And that's a really big deal here in the United States and abroad. Another important point is sperm donation, although eugenic and claims that, you know, you get the best, the brightest, the medical testing or screening that these gentlemen undergo is pretty lax to none. So there's really no screening, so to speak, for those folks. And again, very low regulation on these issues. So all of this mixed together leads to the new modern family. Things that we're seeing are a global, chaotic, unregulated fertility industry that has blossomed into a multi-billion dollar industry across the globe, which has led to women getting pregnant who are postmenopausal, maybe like grandmother surrogacies. They're getting pregnant for their children. We're seeing what we call litter births with twins and triplets. And again, kind of getting away from that. Twiblings and triplings, so where genetic siblings are being carried by two different women, will have all kinds of different family structures, single mothers by choice, single dads by choice, co-parenting where they're not together, homosexual parenting. And this is an important one to kind of speak on for a second, because in the United States, what we'll see is perhaps two dads, two gay men, and they will utilize an egg donor to create a child, maybe their own sperm, one of the male sperm, and then a separate surrogate mother, separate woman to be the surrogate mother. So this will be two women involved. And the reason is kind of intentional. It's to separate out so that neither woman can really claim motherhood or that the child is theirs. So there's a genetic component and then someone who's carrying the child. So again, who is this child's family and who should go on birth certificates? We see, of course, gamete donation and save your siblings. And then now we have two challenges with selective reduction, which is maybe the surrogate mother is pregnant with twins, but the intended parents only want one child. So they'll reduce down one of the healthy children. There's also new technology like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and testing, where they weed out or select the best embryos for transfer or use. So we're seeing all kinds of things, and this is a global issue because there's, again, no standards in this. Okay, so I want to give just a really, really brief history of this technology before we continue. So first we have artificial insemination, which is just the insemination of sperm into a woman. The first case of that is in the late 1700s. And then the first case with a donor was about 100 years later in the late 1800s. In the United States, at least, it became publicly accepted in the 50s and then legal by the 60s. William Pancoast was the first gentleman who did the case with a donor, a professor here in the United States in Philadelphia. And he took his, quote, best looking student and inseminated a woman who was under anesthesia without her knowledge or consent. So very eugenic in nature from its start. Egg donation Again, I like to use that in quotes. The first known case of that was in Australia in the late 1980s. And then most of us are aware of the first test tube baby known as Louise Brown, who was from IVF. And then surrogacy, of course, traditional surrogacy, some say, you know, it's got its roots in biblical literature, but gestational surrogacy, where there's no true genetic link between the child and the mother, was in also the 1980s. Let's see here, we'll move on to next. I want to just kind of focus in really quick on the first IVF baby with an egg donor with Dr. Alan Trunson. He also went on, again, this just this eugenic component and showing that eggs have really become a commodity, not just in this world of big fertility, but also in research and stem cell development, et cetera. But Dr. Alan Trunson, who did one of the first egg donation practices in Australia, he went on to be president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine and Stem Cell Therapy here with California Prop 71. And I do want to make a note really quickly. I'm going to go back a slide. I apologize. I want to talk about IVF for just one second, because I talked about how artificial insemination was very eugenic in its nature, taking the best looking men and impregnating women with their sperm. IVF also very eugenic in its creation. Robert Edwards, one of the inventors of IVF, was an active member of Britain's Eugenic Society. Later in his life, this is an important quote, while celebrating the 25th birthday or anniversary of Louise Brown in the 90s, he said, quote, IVF was more than about infertility. I wanted to find out exactly who was in charge, whether it was God or whether it was scientists in the laboratory. Edwards' conclusion was, quote, it was us. It was the scientists in the laboratory. So that's just very telling to me, kind of the headspace of this technology and creation of it. We often get blindsided by the stories of infertility and feel very, the language used is, of course, we want to help families, of course, but there is this eugenic component we can't really gloss over. So now we'll go on. So with this technology, we have deconstructed our reproductive bodies. The birth control pill made it so that we could have sex without procreation. And now this reproductive technology, now we can have procreation without the sex. So we've taken embryos out of the womb, we're taking gametes, sperm, and eggs out of the bodies, and kind of anything right now is imaginable and conceivable. So where will we go? Like I stated, we educate through film. So I'm going to start with our first clip. We're going to dive deeper into egg donation. Our clip on this was exploitation, so I'm going to play that now. There is a little bit of brief silence, so if you don't hear anything right away, don't freak out. It's not you. It's just the film starts with a little bit of silence.
And we see young women being looked at as a market for eggs.
If you're tall, attractive, physically fit, and have a desire to help. And what person doesn't want to see themselves that way?
You have to be attractive woman of all ethnicity between the age of 21 and 29. So that's also pretty screwed up, I think.
On top of that, they looked for someone with a very good education. They did an IQ test on me.
Look at this, it's a elite donor. So that means obviously you have to go through a process. They don't want just any egg.
And so I did the math and I figured out that I needed about $3,000. And if I had that $3,000, everything would be fine.
I just very much had the altruistic piece of me triggered.
Everything that happened to me was a chain of events where certain medical risks were not taken into account.
And when he saw my distended abdomen, his face went white.
He really emphasized the fact that backing out was not acceptable. They portrayed it as us betraying them. We were no longer in control at that point.
So I think the whole time I felt like they were trying to get rid of me.
And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Oh, Alexandra, we will try to save your ovary, but you may lose your ovary."
I did make poor decisions as a result of the financial compensation.
And I made a decision to sell my eggs. That affected my ability to reproduce.
I mean, I can't have my own children now.
My story isn't documented in any statistics anywhere.
They become forgotten. They're a faceless person that comes in and donates their eggs, and then they're gone.
So that's just one clip, kind of the trailer of the film Exploitation, which spotlights the whole film itself, the booming business of human eggs. And it's told through the stories of real women who became involved and whose lives have changed forever. And we're going to briefly talk about some of those women. And, you know, in the film, they talk about, they talk about these advertisements that they saw. So these are, again, these are from the United States. So I don't have ads on this slide from other countries. It might be worth a little search on your own time. But these are the ads that are kind of on college campuses, on social media, Craigslist. They are recruited through Craigslist, social media, college newspapers, and they offer anywhere from $5,000 to $100,000 US dollars. The higher end, that's often manipulative. They'll say that that's what they offer, but then once the woman gets into the clinic, then it's, oh, it's a little bit less, you don't have this qualification, et cetera, et cetera. These ads rarely make mention of any potential health risk. As you see on here, I don't think one of these ads that I just randomly selected at random makes any mention of any known short-term risks or unknown long-term risk. What they highlight are all things positive. You can make significant compensation fairly quickly, all while continuing your studies, will not interrupt your schoolwork. And of course, you are selected to help a family create the family of their dreams. There's a very altruistic component. In the United States, we do have some, depending on the state, regulations on how these ads can be placed. However, there is no compliance or regulatory body that's making sure that they're following the regulations. They are supposed to have the risks. They don't. We still see that they do not. So take that for what it's worth. So then we'll continue with Maggie's story. This is based off of Exploitation. It's a much shorter film. You can watch it in less than 20 minutes. And this is one woman's story of learning about helping others, how she responded to the ads to give them a child that they so desperately wanted, and then the consequences that followed. She was told how special she was, and I'll let the clip speak for itself, but she was used repeatedly for others' gain and ended up with with stage 4 invasive ductal carcinoma. And so the money that she did end up receiving was ended up being spent on tests, treatments, and her unknown prognosis at the time. So we'll play this one.
It's important to me to be able to help people. They're always looking for really intelligent women with a good background that would be interested in helping other people. And at the time I was 19 or 20, and I just thought, wow, that's a way that I could help people, and I'm not using my eggs. You kind of develop this train of thought where you really want to be chosen. It would be something special to be one of the chosen ones that could help people. I definitely was not forced. I didn't feel like I was coerced, but I do think that I was a little naive, and it didn't occur to me that I could say, no, because in my mind, I would have been saying, no, I don't want to help people anymore.
All right, and so the film, these are the faces you'll see in the film, real women, real stories. And I'm just gonna go through a couple of them now. So first we have Alexandra, and I just put their quotes there because I feel like learning from people's stories is a better way to learn. So as a result of selling her eggs, she survived a torsioned ovary, intestinal failure, and a body cavity infection. She also had a later diagnosis of breast cancer, which required both of her breasts to be cut off, and 18 months of chemo and radiation. She is grateful to be alive, but all of this could have been avoided had she not sold her eggs. So there's her, Alexandra. Next, we have Kylie. After the procedure, Kylie started throwing up instantly and was unbelievably sick. She describes it as the worst flu she could ever imagine. She woke up the next morning and couldn't move, was weak. Her boyfriend told the doctor that she can't keep water down. The doctor kept saying, it's okay, it's okay. I believe she reached out to the medical team 3 or 4 times before finally going in. And she ended up suffering a stroke because she had ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. That's her in the hospital afterwards. And then last, we'll talk about Cindy. Cindy suffered a punctured ovarian artery from the egg collection procedure itself. She says, even though I suffered immediate life-threatening complications from the process, it wasn't until many more years of medical training, Cindy went on to be a physician, that she was able to understand the full scope of how she was taken advantage of and abandoned by this industry. She was given $6,500 for her egg donations. And that also went into medical treatments for her complications. And she also developed post-traumatic stress disorder. And she was unable to work for 2 months due to her medical and mental health deterioration. It's important to know with Cindy's story, this was a complication of the procedure itself, that the rates of complications for these procedures are not available or not readily available, at least in the United States, unless individual programs collect them as part of their own quality assurance and data collection. Most registries, if there is one, will focus on cycle outcomes, such as how many pregnancies were created, how many live births resulted, but they don't collect information on the procedural outcomes or complications of those procedures or complications and health risk of the women after their procedure, which we'll get into that a little bit more in the next couple of slides. So these women are told that there are no known long-term risks. And a young woman might take that to mean that there are no long-term risks. Those are not the same thing. Unlike sperm donation, it's very easy for a man to donate sperm. It doesn't require a medical process. It can be hard on women. It is hard on women to retrieve eggs. The medical procedure is lengthy, and there are known risks that we know of with each step, such as ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, loss of fertility. So this woman is going in to help someone else and might lose her own fertility in the process. Ovarian torsion, like in Alexandra's case, stroke in Kylie's case, kidney disease, early menopause, ovarian cysts, and death. Ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is life-threatening, and it can cause a stroke as well as other things. The current estimates, people always like to know numbers, how many. Again, we don't study these women. We don't keep track of them like in organ donation. But the estimates are somewhere around 10%, but that's underreported. Women who are not infertile, so these young women who are donating their eggs, they're at more an increased risk for developing ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome because they are more responsive to the hormones, because they're not infertile. They're not, again, they're not patients. So they're more likely to have OHSS. So here's another little clip of just the experts chatting about this.
Well, the list of dangers for egg retrieval in women would include the OHSS, which would in its of itself put a woman at risk for pulmonary complications, fluid imbalances, a stroke, death.
There have been no studies done on long-term health consequences to the egg donors.
You're talking about 200 million eggs. The numbers are just staggering.
Nowhere in the world has anybody done any research on the aftermath of the drugs on women who've been donating, or often it's not donating, selling eggs across any of the countries that are involved in this kind of trade. They become forgotten.
So I think that last point, they become forgotten. They're not tracked in any medical statistics, literature, tracking database. And the lack of data, the lack of short-term and long-term data on egg supplier health post-surgery is caused by this lack of regulation across the globe in fertility clinics and the industry as a whole. So regulation would require fertility clinics and others to maintain and monitor this egg supplier data, which they won't do, egg supplier registries. There's no requirement to follow up on women who provide their eggs once the extraction is over. Again, they are forgotten in medical history, and we've been doing this for some time now. And likely because the fertility industry makes billions of dollars in profits, they don't want to look under behind the curtain in the closet, because I think that they'll find that this is a harmful practice and they'll have to report on that. California, the United States, is the Wild West of fertility treatment and is a major destination for folks around the world. So I don't think that they have any desire to do these studies, even though they clearly need to be done. And the absence of this data does not mean that there is an absence of risk. When cigarettes first came out, nobody knew how harmful they were or were aware of those health risks. This is just an example. And now, thanks to social media, internet, education, films like ours, more women are starting to speak out about how this industry has harmed them and the consequences of this industry. So next we can chat, how many egg donors are there? Again, it's unknown. We don't know how many women egg donors exist in the world at any given time because no one's tracking them. We can get an idea in the United States, the Center for the CDC, they do track some cycles performed loosely. We saw that fresh donor eggs in 2020 were about 1,500 cycles, and then the number of cycles performed using frozen eggs or embryos actually jumped from about 7,000 in 2011 to 22,000, over 22,000 in 2020. So there is a very high demand for these eggs, and not just again in the fertility business, but through stem cells, research, et cetera, which is why egg donor compensation is pretty high, and why scientists use animal eggs in their research. Globally, we can get an idea of about how many women are used by looking at data from the International Committee for Monitoring Assisted Reproductive Technologies, ICMART. In 2018, I believe is the last data, there are about 3,000 clinics around 80 countries, and they found that there were over 160,000 egg donation transfers. So again, a very, very large number. So we have kind of this dichotomy of what you hear about egg donation and the reality. What we hear is that egg donors are angels. They give informed consent. It's a light procedure. There's really no risk, and you're helping someone have a baby. But in fact, donors are exploited. They're considered genetic material. Of note, once they give up their eggs, it's no longer theirs, right? Those eggs could be really used for anything, even though they might have indicated that they really only want them to use for X, Y, or Z. They can be used outside of that. Informed consent is impossible. You can't give consent to things you don't know. If you're not told of the health risks, that's not true informed consent. And we know this in the medical community. Surgery is invasive. There are risks and side effects. And you're not helping someone have a baby. You are helping someone have your baby. That is your egg. Really important distinction there. So I'm going to transition a little bit to the anonymous Father's Day film, which kind of covers both egg and sperm, anonymous gamete donation. Again, there's no way to know how many children are conceived each year through gametes, those both eggs and sperm, because there's no tracking or database to monitor these numbers. And there's really little to no awareness of donor-conceived individuals. Again, because of the advancement in technology and social media, this is changing. We're starting to see donor-conceived individuals speak out about how they feel about being the result of anonymous gamete donation. And again, donation, these are often paid interactions. So we'll watch a brief clip on this film to highlight the devastating impact of some of these children who are now adults.
I want to find my biological father because he is an important part of my life. I wouldn't be here without him. I want to look in his face, or at least look at a picture of him, and I know that I'm going to see myself. I look in the mirror and I don't know who I look like.
Secrets are like landmines, you know, they can go off at any time.
2/3 of young people who were conceived through sperm donation believe they have the right to know who their fathers are.
Until I was 20 years old, the only thing I knew about my biological father was that he was blonde with blue eyes and he had a college degree.
My sister and I set out on a quest to see if we could find anything more about the man who made us and the 500 or 1,000 half-siblings that I have.
There's definitely an element of baby buying, baby selling.
I have seen the effects on young people who realize that they are the result of a commodification.
His donor number is 81, and that's basically all I know about him.
Nobody has the right to withhold significant personal information about a person from that person.
There really is a growing community of people who are making their voices heard, and they're angry about what's been done to them, and they want to stop it for future generations.
If we're going to have these technologies, then they need to work first and foremost for the people that they directly affect, the children who are being born.
I thought, wow, I'm one of the first produced by science and not sex.
Should we be conceiving children in the first place who will be deliberately denied the ability to know and be known by their father?
It's quite possible to be grateful for your life and question aspects of your conception.
I want to know that story. I want my children to know where they came from. And if I don't find him, it won't be because I didn't look for him.
Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit quickly through the next sections because we have focused on egg donation. I don't want to run out of time, but you have the slides, and I'll provide my email at the end for questions on things I didn't go over. But again, we'll get back to this. Anonymous gamete donation now, there's no such thing. With the DNA technology wave and introduction of things at home like 23andMe and Ancestry, there's really no such thing as anonymity anymore. And some countries are starting to change that. Denver, Colorado is the first state in the United States that as of 2025 will end anonymity. Australia was the first country in the world to do so. And then there are others. Importantly, though, most of these places that have laws, the child has to be 18 to get their medical information or to find out. So for 18 years, they may not know who makes up their genetic material. But then at 18, they can get that information. So it's still not perfect. And they're often without important medical information about their lives. So even though there are places doing the right thing, I think it needs to be an immediate, there just should be no anonymous gamete donation whatsoever. So what we hear is that it's safe, it's a harmless way to make money, and of course they're helping families. But what we see is that the children are turning into adults now and they are upset. they have a right to know about their conception. 70% wonder about the sperm donor's family, their half siblings. In the slide or in the film clip I shared, you know, over almost 1,000 half siblings. And many feel like they have a right to know their donor identity. And their genetic information can be the difference between life and death if they have a medical condition. And again, you're helping someone have not a baby, but your baby. And then lastly, we have just a tip of the iceberg. And again, I'll go through this quickly. A film about surrogacy. Often a surrogate will be carrying a donor egg from another donor, another woman, not just the intended parent. So you can't have this conversation without talking about surrogate mothers.
The thought that there are people that couldn't have children or that struggled to have children was just something that really touched me.
My understanding was that it would be me being a stay-at-home mom and him providing the financial support for that.
I had such a wonderful, beautiful experience with surrogacy that I thought, why wouldn't I do it again?
We expected a happy ending.
Infertility is an age-old problem. It's been with us since almost the beginning of time.
A family is love. Long gone are the days where we have a mom and a dad and two children.
As wonderful as other people might be as parents, the baby knows that that's not the mother they were expecting.
Some of the pieces of the puzzle didn't fit, so it was just a relief to find out why.
The babies were born 2 weeks premature.
They were getting ready to walk out of the room, and I said, please, can I please see him?
When I was going to visit the babies, one of the hospital social workers showed up. She said, I understand we have a surrogacy situation here.
In many jurisdictions, there's no law at all that speaks to how to resolve disputes that arise in the context of assisted reproductive technologies.
There are so many other people involved.
It is not just her uterus that she's renting, it's her entire body.
Having to try to find a way to build a family outside the normal channels is very stressful for everyone. It's very difficult for us to stand in judgment.
It's important that we listen to and hear these stories.
Most of the consideration within surrogacy is towards the adults and what they want and what they're looking for.
This child's foundation of existence is a contract, an agreement, and more often than not, money. That's not in the best interest of a child.
I do believe it can be a wonderful, beautiful thing, but...
So here we have some of the women on the top row who are featured in the film that you saw, and then women on the bottom, just briefly, Brittany Rose and Melissa Cook were both women carrying twins and triplets who were told to selectively reduce their pregnancies and reached out to us. Michelle and Brooke and Crystal are all women in the United States who died during their surrogate pregnancies. So just real faces to put on these stories.
Surrogacy is fast becoming one of the major issues of the 21st century. But what are the implications for women's health and human rights? What happens when a surrogate is forced to sever the natural bond with the child she carried? What happens when surrogates are coerced to abort healthy children? What happens when surrogacy costs a woman her health or even her life? The bottom line, surrogacy hurts women.
We actually did our own research in this topic, and this can be found online for free through Dignity, so I won't go too much into it, other than just to highlight that we did find that surrogate pregnancies are high risk. They have four times higher odds of resulting in a C-section, early and delivering prematurely, and more likely to experience adverse effects, including postpartum depression. There are outcomes, and this is consistent with other data that's out there in medical journals, that these pregnancies do cause a maternal risk. And we know medical professionals know that if a mom is a high risk, that automatically defers risk to the unborn child as well.
Personally, I'm 100% against it. I don't understand the purpose of it. I believe that there are too many children who need homes in this world.
The primal wound is what happens when you separate a baby and its mother. Babies know their own mothers through all their senses, and when they, for some reason, the baby is separated from that mother, the prenatal bonding is interrupted. There is a trauma that happens to both the baby and the mother.
There needs to be more education on the downfalls of surrogacy. I think that it's too easy to look at surrogacy from the point of view of what are my wants, what are my desires, and how do I get them met, but it's a lot harder to look at how it could possibly affect a child.
This is just another study that was done in 2017 that looked at both neonatal outcomes as well as maternal outcomes of gestational surrogates. And again, there are increased adverse perinatal outcomes, preterm birth, low birth weight for the baby. And then, of course, increased hypertension, so high blood pressure and maternal diabetes and placental previa in the mothers. And then in the previous clip, they talked a little bit about that maternal fetal bond and the primal wound. This is really important. These women are going home with empty arms, higher risk of postpartum depression. They might be pumping. Their hormones are still changing and elevating. And there's a couple quotes there you can read. And then the children, Jessica Kern, she's a woman born of surrogacy and speaks out against it. And how it is an adult or parent-centered view without thinking about the child. I think it's interesting in the World Health Organization really promotes breastfeeding as the best practice, but yet we are taking away these infants from the only home that they know, and we're intentionally severing that at surrogacy. So there's a lot to say about this primal wound. I just encourage you all to kind of look into that and dive a little bit deeper there. And around the globe, commercial surrogacy is prohibited by many countries on a human rights and women's health grounds. There's been a lot of news on this right now with the Pope saying that surrogacy is deplorable. There's news out of Italy trying to criminalize those who do surrogacy abroad. Thailand had closed its borders in 2015 after some high profile cases and some bad press. But there's news for them to reopen, which is really disheartening. Around the globe, it just makes for really hard to regulate this and just makes for reproductive tourism. So again, kind of to go back to our realities, what you hear versus realities. Again, we hear in the language how the surrogate is an angel. She's helping a family. You know, those cases with legal issues are rare. You don't need to worry about them. The contracts or regulation protects the surrogate mother. It's easy to detach. But really, the reality is that this is a commercialization of children. Surrogates can be threatened and bullied. We see that a number of times. And that gestation matters. They do bond with their babies, and these babies are being ripped from the only home that they've known. So in summary, now we have, with all of these reproductive technologies, really reproductive trafficking. We've traded on the body. We have reproductive tourism globally, the consumerism and commodification and exploitation of women and children. And this is an international problem. We need to close borders and really abolish these practices. I just want to let you know that all of the films can be found on YouTube, our YouTube channel at cbc-network.org. There's a Think Again study guide I'm happy to send out as well that kind of goes along with each of these videos. And you can find and follow us on our website as well as other social media platforms. And I can open it up for questions now, or how you want to do that.
Thank you so much, Kelly. That was hugely helpful and very disturbing. A lot of it. So very appreciative of all that you've shared with us. We've got a few minutes and there are a few questions that have come in. So let me just I'm afraid those who've asked questions will probably only get time to do one or two of them, but let me just throw one out to you first. What you've done really helpfully is highlighted a lot of the ethical and health implications. You've also hinted at some of the socioeconomic factors at play. So this question is basically asking, in societies where egg donation is prevalent, there's often a complex interplay of the socioeconomic factors influencing individual decisions to donate. So he's asking how we can, the questioner is asking how we can address the systemic issues to ensure mainly, I guess, that egg donors are empowered to make informed choices without being too pressured and influenced by financial incentives or societal pressures. And I guess that's the finances. Certainly I can back that up with many stories I've heard, as you put on that screen, it's poor women who donate, it's not wealthy women. But this is a systemic issue, and a lot of women are in financial difficulty. So how do we address that?
Yeah, there's been some research done on this as far as, like, you know, systemically, you know, a lot of these women are in college and are using the funds for education. So, you know, maybe it starts with education and providing better financial assistance for education. But I think as a whole, you know, I believe to abolish these practices is the best way. But I think first, as a stepping stone, is to get rid of the financial factor completely. Let's go back and let's do this the way we do organ donation, at least in the United States, where they're given a packet, thick, full packet of information, which would require us to do some research to stop what we're doing, research these outcomes so that we can truly give informed consent, just like in donation of other body parts. We take out the financial gain completely. We do know that there are ways, especially in the United Kingdom and others, where they go around that. They're paying for other things, such as clothing, et cetera, whatever. But we make it truly, we take out the financial component completely. I think that's the only way. Will they do that? I don't know.
Yeah, another aspect to that actually that happens in the UK, and interestingly, actually happened to the daughter of a friend of mine. She was infertile, wanted to do IVF, and she was basically persuaded and offered to donate. She had to donate half her eggs, which gave her a reduced price for IVF treatment. So she donated those to someone else. The IVF treatment for her didn't work, but she couldn't afford the IVF treatment. That's why she tried it. And really sadly for her, the woman that she donated eggs to had a child from her own eggs. And this lady didn't have a child. But again, she was persuaded simply because it was the only way she could afford IVF. And in the end, she was left far more traumatized. Financial issues is a really big issue. So a couple of other questions I think we've got time for. Thomas asks, what do you advise a PCP in the US to do?
That's a great question. I advise there's a lot of new technologies. And just in the last few years that I've learned about personally, if you have a family that's having a hard time with infertility, to refer them to someone like a NAPRO technologist or someone who's doing holistic healthcare in this, because infertility is not the disease, it's a symptom of something. So figuring out what's causing that. And they are all around. One is on our board, but NAPRO technologists and those who are practicing holistic care are really trying to figure out why they're infertile and really empower women and empower men who are struggling with this, rather than just a quick fix of, well, this is how we get a baby. We're going to take all this out of your body. We're going to combine it in a tube, and then we're going to put it back in someone else's or your body. Let's find the problem. Let's get the solution. Let's provide really good healthcare in that sense. And I don't think a lot of men and women know that those types of practitioners exist who are there to help. And I think another thing is just to be really honest and to have folks who are considering donating their eggs or becoming surrogates to not just hear from fertility clinics, but to hear from men and women who've walked this path and now might have regrets or who've had complications.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. Another really good question that I'd be very interested in your answer as well. Do you have a priority list of the changes you hope to create in the systems that sustain this industry? And he goes on to say, what would be the single most effective change you could cause to happen that would overcome this exploitation?
Oh, that's a tough question, though. And again, I think it's the scientist in me wants to say, let's do research, let's stop everything and do research. But I think honestly, the biggest impact we can have is, again, taking money out of this completely. There's no more money to be had. Women don't get to get paid for their services, because I think, you know, New York State legalized commercial surrogacy. That's because there weren't altruistic women lining up at the doors. They had a real deficit in women who were offering to become surrogate mothers. And so they legalized it. They legalized commercial surrogacy. So I think if we take money out of this, this will help a lot.
Yeah, no, but yeah, thank you. Another one says, thank you very much for a great session. What happens if the baby of the surrogate mum is found to have an abnormality or genetic condition like Down's?
Often they're...
It will vary according to country, but yeah.
Yeah, so there's new technology that you can pay for, which is actually, have a podcast where I talk to an embryologist out of the UK about this and how, but there's new technology that's actually not very good. It's parents are exploited to pay for this technology so they can find out ahead of time if the embryo they're implanting has these diseases, so they can be weeded out ahead of time. They're not very accurate. And again, the parents, the intended parents, are being exploited in this realm. And I talk about this on my podcast with the, I'm blanking on her name. I'm so sorry. So in cases where maybe the parents don't do that, or a child with Down syndrome snuck by, often those children are aborted, or we've even seen stories, again, probably everyone knows of the baby Gammy story out of Thailand, where that baby was, there were twins, the little girl was genetically normal or within normal limits, and the little boy had Down syndrome. The little boy was left in Thailand and the parents took the little girl home. Mm-hmm. That's part of what caused Thailand to close its borders, cases like that. That happens. And for me, people say, oh, that's one case. One is too many. One is too many. That is a precious little boy. Unfortunately, bad cases happen when those conditions happen too.
I think there's time for one more question, probably a couple of minutes if you can do this, but this is a great question, I think, to end on. And it's a really important one, actually, given the stigma associated with infertility in many countries around the world, there's a great stigma of infertility. How can we as Christian doctors better support such patients using the Bible rather than science?
Yeah, I think you hit a nail on the head. There is a huge stigma on that. And I think the biggest thing too is just supporting our patients. And for those of us who are not physicians, supporting the people in our communities who are dealing with infertility. I often tell couples who are struggling with infertility, oh, we just want to have a family. You are a family. You and your partner, you and your husband, you and your wife, you are a family already. There are ways for you to sow into other people's lives. I know that's not an answer. We don't always get what we want, right? We want a child. Those desires are good. But there are many stories where we don't always get what we want or desire, even though those are good desires. Again, though, I think I would just help refer patients back to physicians who are skilled in this, who are going to empower the couple to find the core issue, rather than just dealing with the infertility to figure out, is this a, what kind of, is this a structural issue? You know, just empowering those couples and supporting them. And it's a challenging topic because there is such a stigma.
Absolutely. I mean, it is difficult. Certainly society now says that everyone has a right to have a child.
Right.
And I think for us as Christians, then we're trying to also just encourage people to think of children as a gift, and again, not a right. And I think it's really important that. But yes, really hard. And there's a lot of tough issues here. But I think we should sadly have to draw this to a close, but I just want to give you huge thanks for all the work you've done in preparing this and all the work that you're doing and campaigning on this and educating people and all the films that you're doing. And it's a remarkable work, and do thank Jennifer as well for her many years of service on this issue. But thank you once again for joining us, and God bless you all. And thank you, Kelly. Okay,
goodbye. Thank you so much.